This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Other people wondering, where's Rick S? I mean, everybody knows you're an amazing dancer, and they said, where's S, man?
Dude, I bend in crazy ways.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man more serious than a government shutdown, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike. How you doing, babe?
So, Rick, did you listen to our April Fool's Gadfly show last week?
Dude, I read it. I got to say that the caliber of writing, very nice. And then the Dance Fever video y'all did, fab. I was touched.
You know, people have responded to that video mostly positively, but people are upset that Checker wasn't in it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had some travel logistics issues. We got some brief footage of him. He wouldn't dance. And anyways, he didn't end up in the video. And other people wondering, where is Rick S? I mean, everybody knows you're an amazing dancer. And they said, where's S, man?
Dude, I bend in crazy ways. But, you know, the thing that's a shame is what folks may not realize is that back when Footloose came out 25 years ago and Checker was with Bill Bennett and them, Checker apparently, now this legend only has, this is before our time, I was in like, you know, 12th grade, but legend has it that Checker could do a ferocious break dance, roll over, kind of boogaloo too, oh man, I would have liked to see that.
Now you're getting it confused. It was Bennett who could break dance. Checker was particularly good at beer slides.
And beatboxing.
And
Checker would go Bennett, go Bennett, go Bennett.
I gotta ask Checker if he ever went on one of Bennett's gambling trips.
I want to see Checker on a beer slide. That would be sweet.
That would be sweet. Or doing a cake stand.
Oh my God. Can you see Checker with like one of those helmets with the two beers?
So, of course, you know, for our listeners, I hope that you all enjoyed the special April Fool's edition of the Gadfly Show last week, which was, of course, you know, a chance for people to hear all the various ways I introduced you and then some of our most interesting, engaging, hilarious banter.
Does it show a lack of respect for the seriousness of education policy, Mike?
Yes, probably does. So, a couple things about seriousness. So, looks like by Friday, decent chance, government shutdown. So I got to wonder, our friends over at 400 Maryland Avenue at the Department of Education probably making their plans right now. I mean, what would you do if you thought, okay, I'm going to have somewhere between 1 day and 3 weeks, let's say, off. How would you organize your life?
It doesn't lend itself to really good vacation planning. That's true.
No. And they can't go into work even if they want to.
And they aren't getting paychecks, which also tends to crimp one's ability to enjoy leisure.
I know, especially during a credit crunch. That really sucks. I did put up on the blog, and this was seriously, that somebody should organize an attempt to try to get these federal employees hooked up with volunteer opportunities in local schools and other service agencies. I think they, you know, you can imagine, you've got all these type A go-getters who are going to be twiddling their thumbs going crazy. They could do a lot of good. Get them to go in, advise a charter school board.
I got to say, flowers, Mike, you're one of the few people I know who's done time at 400 Maryland who talks about type A go-getters.
Yeah, and this is important. I mean, look, you got to understand that let's say somebody told me this when I first came in there. They said the top third of people who work at the Department of Education are just as good as the top third of people you'd find in any organization. Middle third, pretty good too. It's the bottom third where things fall off. I think that's true. There's some really talented, smart, driven people that work over there, both political appointees and career staff. And I don't know what they're going to be doing with themselves. So I'm just saying maybe they can help fix some schools. Do something, you know, useful for a change. Well, all right.
Wait a minute. But you just said they were type A go-getters, and now they don't do anything useful?
Well, they're type A go-getters that spend their days frustrated by running, you know, hitting their head up against a brick wall.
Ah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, lots going on. Let's get started with Pardon the Gadfly, and Daniela's here to read the questions.
Hey, guys. So, question number one. Despite its infancy and controversy, California's parent trigger legislation is gaining popularity across the country, with states like Ohio, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania considering their own legislation. Is this a good thing?
Now, Rick, I know you're not on Twitter, but let me explain why this is a bad thing. Okay, why is it too bad that you're not on Twitter? I saw a tweet the other day of saying to Jeb Bush tweeting, you know, way to go, John Kasich, for embracing the parent trigger. And then John Kasich saying back, thanks, Jeb. It was pretty cool. Isn't that cool?
Meanwhile, neither of those tweets were written by Kasich or
Jeb. Oh, come on.
Why is that cool?
Yeah, I'm getting to see this like personal, private communication going on between, you know, Governor Kasich in Ohio and Jeb Bush in Florida.
You know, my biggest concern out of that is the fact that governors are spending their time reading their tweets to see if Jeb is sending them a thumbs up tweet.
Rick, until you have spent any time on Twitter, I'm just not going to take your opinion seriously about this new form of media. Okay.
That works for me. That works for me.
All right. What's up with the parent trigger? I think we've talked about this before, but I just don't get it.
The world's all a Twitter about it. I had to go there.
All right. Back to serious things. I mean, my take is this. Look, I get the idea of trying to get parents energized and mobilized to take charge. And I guess it's akin to a charter conversion issue, kind of like the teacher trigger, where teachers could vote to have their school converted to a charter. This is like the parent trigger. But what happens? The parents trigger it, and then what? How does that then lead to actually some kind of positive turnaround takeover situation?
Oh, Mike, you're just being skeptical. I mean, hey, think about it. We'll look at what we've learned under school improvement plans, under No Child Left Behind, that if schools go into corrective action, they make plans.
Mm-hmm.
And then you even reconstitute schools.
All right, but let's be serious here. The question is...
I'm being dead serious.
There's some smart people out there. Ben Austin's a smart guy who's mm-hmm. leading this stuff. I mean, is it simply that they just want to take over these schools and have them handed over to Green Dot? Is that the point? Because the guy leading this is, you know, it's a parent revolution.
I don't think it's an implementation-driven strategy. I think it's actually the exact same strategy as NCLB, which is the argument that if you create awareness, you create energy, you give parents a way to get into the game, that somehow some better stuff is going to happen out the other side. I don't think there's actually a particularly coherent set of notions as to how once you activate a parent trigger, it leads to better schooling.
I think we agree on that. Okay, topic two. By the way, I forgot to say this is a special Gadfly edition where it's the Skeptical Reformers edition.
Oh.
And you'll see why, what I mean. Okay, Daniela, topic number two.
So, Rick, you wrote a pretty scathing blog post against Florida's recently passed teacher tenure teacher evaluation bill. Why does the new Florida law get your goat?
So Florida just passed Senate Bill 736. The new governor signed it into law. It's a slightly tweaked version of Senate Bill 6 that Florida surfaced last year. Last year, if folks may recall that, you know, this is a bill that said we're going to do away with Florida teacher tenure. We're going to pretty much wipe the slate of the step in line pay scale. And I think that stuff's terrific. It creates lots of room for districts and schools to figure out new ways to do it. So at the time, what Senate Bill 6 proposed was replacing all of that with hundreds of value added metrics for Florida teachers and all the different configurations of classes that would have to be designed and implemented. And then specified that teachers would be evaluated and would keep or not keep their jobs based on those value added results, and that those would drive teacher pay. I said I thought that was a mess, but I said I can endorse Senate Bill 6 for the same reason President Obama said it was okay to go with health care reform. It was a mess, but he said at least it was a step forward and we'll fix it later. Well, Senate Bill 6 got vetoed by the governor, by then Governor Christ, didn't go anywhere. And so we came back. They had another year, another bite at the apple. They got to see Colorado's 191. And what came back was a bill was, to my taste, was just as prescriptive and just as problematic about the simple-minded emphasis on value added as Senate Bill 6 was. And so that gives me grave doubts that anybody's going to actually go ahead and address these problems over specification. And I can't. And that's not good for me.
Okay, so the basic problem is, first of all, that you're prescribing at the state level how teachers are going to be evaluated, and then that's going to drive decisions around dismissal and around pay. And one argument is just a local control issue, right? You say, hey, leave it to districts, leave it to local schools, leave it to local charter schools. I mean, let people figure this out what they want to do.
That's right. Because one thing they notice is that charters are actually wrapped into the system. So charters are now required to evaluate and pay teachers the same way as these other teachers in Florida.
Right. But, you know, the devil's advocate would say, look, if you don't do this at the state level, then most school districts will just keep their single salary schedule and steps and lanes and all the rest, and nothing will actually change.
Sure. So there's a couple different ways to address it. One is, honestly, I got to say, I don't think this stuff's ready for prime time. Rather than force 60-odd districts in Florida to do a version of this that we know is going to cause problems, frankly, I'd rather take a few more years and bribe and bring, you know, handful of districts into doing this smart. Second is Colorado's 191, for instance, is much less prescriptive about how you actually use the value-added data and how do you drive the system off it. Problem is, right, you could take 3 years' data. You got a teacher's got 25 kids a year for 3 years, 75 kids. By the time you deal with attrition in a place like Miami-Dade, maybe looking at 45, 50 kids. Look, we know that there's going to be huge concerns about reliability and validity in that data year over year. Districts are going to be required by the state to terminate teachers who parents think are pretty decent teachers who are working in pretty decent schools because the numbers aren't there. And they're going to have no two ways about it. This is not a way to build public support for a workable, sustainable, you know, 21st century system.
No, and if you want to see cheating, if you want to see teaching to the test, I mean, this is really ramping up the pressure on those things. Okay, topic number three.
The Ohio legislature is debating a far-reaching voucher bill aimed to expand the state vouchers program to its middle class families. What are the promises and pitfalls of the program?
So let me be clear when they say middle class. In Ohio, this bill that's under consideration would allow any family making up to $100,000 a year to have a pretty significant voucher to send their kid to a private school. And looks like, at least over time, would allow kids who are already in private schools to take part of this. And the question is, in a time of a fiscal crunch, not enough money, is this the, you know, this kind of middle class giveaway something that we want to support?
Oh, I'm actually down with that. That part works for me. The part that
what works for what?
We're 100,000 eligibility. I'm fine for including a voucher. And those dollars, you know what? I mean, my understanding at least is I think the voucher amount is less than per people outlays in Ohio, right?
Right.
So, honestly, I got to say, if districts were run, run the way they could be run, I don't actually see this as a dollar-losing proposition for them. But the problem here, I think, is the notion that a lot of middle-class families in suburban districts are eager for school choice. They've bought their homes because they kind of like their school. Their problem is not that they're eager to get their kid out of an obviously awful or unsafe school. Their problem is that they don't like the reading program, or they don't like what the school's doing for gifted children. And that's not a school choice question. That's really a question of creating opportunities to customize and to offer new services through the existing school. And, you know, whole school choice of the kind that works really well for stuck, at-risk urban kids doesn't do a lot for middle class and suburban families.
That's interesting. But back to the means testing bit. You're in support of universal vouchers?
Yeah. I mean, basically, now I don't think 100,000 is universal. I mean, Mike, I know that you make well under 100,000, so you need, oh, wait a minute. No, you don't. But you're still a working family. You guys don't live in some mansion.
No, in fact, we're selling our 1,200 square foot house this week, if anybody's interested.
So I gotta say, the notion that, you know, that a family with two working parents that makes 90 or 95,000 is so rolling in dough that they ought to obviously be ineligible for a voucher like this, I think, I think it just does not jibe with my read on, you know, how hard it is to make ends meet for families nowadays.
Okay, I'm more skeptical than Rick on this one. Okay, so let's do the score here. We are both skeptical on the parent trigger. We're both skeptical on the Florida teacher bill, and we're both skeptical on the Ohio voucher bill, but for different reasons.
I like it.
Very nice. But regardless, we're skeptical.
We're skeptical guys.
Yes. Okay, Daniela, thanks for joining us for Pardon the Gadfly.
Thanks, guys.
It's now time for everyone's favorite Amber Winkler's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Now, I think we should get this out of the way. Okay. You and Rick will be spending some time this weekend down at the AERA conference, New Orleans.
We love it. Hanging out at Pato's.
Do you know, I've been going to AERA since the mid-90s, and I believe this will be the first time that Fordham has been in the house.
That's not true. I came one year.
Did you?
You forget?
I forget.
Yes, I was there one year.
How many years ago was that?
I don't remember. Actually, I flew into one that was in Chicago. Oh, it was in San Francisco.
Oh. Oh, I do remember that.
You remember we hung out. Yes. We spent like half a day together.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was great. So this will be the second time.
And if I don't come back with something that could possibly resemble a new research idea, I'll never be back again.
So, and if listeners want to join us, we'll be hanging at Pato's on Bourbon.
Oh, we will.
Swing on by.
Now, isn't there a particular time they need to meet you there? Or you make it sound like you'll be there
Well,
like
Rick
24/7.
Will be there multiple nights.
I'll be there
Saturday.
The floating cocktail party. I'll be there 4 to 8 most days.
But surely at 4 o'clock there are still sessions going on. I mean, won't you be at sessions, Rick, listening carefully to the latest research?
Mm-hmm.
Have you picked out some of your favorite ones you're going to go to?
I think there was a column this morning. But as Whitney likes to explain to people when they're asking, is Rick really going? She says that when Rick says he's going to ERA, what she really means is he is going to visit various eating and drinking establishments in the general vicinity.
There we have it.
Did you register for the conference?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm actually doing a couple panels and stuff.
Okay, all right. Good.
I'm doing an EWA conversation with Sandy Kress and somebody else on reauthorization.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
There you go. earning your keep.
All right. Well, Amber, what do you have for us this week?
All right. We have a new study about student attrition and school finance in KIPP schools. The study's received lots of attention and ignited some controversy this week. It was conducted by researchers at Western Michigan University using CCD data. From 06-07 to 08-09, researchers compare attrition rates for individual KIPP schools to rates in their local public school districts and conclude that KIPP schools have much higher levels of attrition than their local school districts. But again, measuring the proportion of students who leave one school to the proportion who may be leaving hundreds of schools is not exactly comparable. Besides that, as many noted, Mathematica's more rigorous study of KIPP attrition, which used individual student level data from last summer, concluded that overall attrition rates in KIPP schools were similar to those in traditional public schools. As for the financial analysis, researchers drew a convenient sample of 25 KIPP schools using 07-08 federal financial data, as well as federal IRS tax forms. They conclude that KIPP schools receive on average roughly $18,500 per pupil compared to the local districts, which receive about $6,500 less. Anyway, I could go on. The sample's skewed. We don't have charters from Florida, New York, and California, to name a few states. We know that California's charters get shortchanged anyway. So anyway, it was a convenient sample, which is not good. KIPP issued a response. They observed that in addition to the problems I've delineated, an analyst didn't distinguish between operating and capital expenses, which is a very big deal. Finally, anyone working in school finance will tell you that you really need to do forensic accounting at the school level. You got to talk to people because we don't have reliable school level data yet, and this study doesn't get us there.
Sure. Amber, tell us how you really feel.
Man, it was bad. It was bad. And everybody knew it was bad, you know? And anyway, and then it got lots of press. And then, you know, our good friend Edgewonk Rotherham did the little tip hat and let us know who was one of the funders of the study, which was obviously pretty clear. But anyway, that would be the AFT.
Mm-hmm. No.
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 Shocking.
I'm shocked.
Or what's an NEA? Boy, I hope one of them. Anyway. So, yeah, not good.
You know, Amber, somebody should do a study of these high-flying charter schools and figure out how much they really spend and what they
somebody
spend
Somebody should.
And guess what?
We're doing it.
And we're going to do it the right way.
Right way, talk to people, go in, really parse what these numbers mean. I mean, it's really, like, heavy lifting. But
well, the capital outlay thing's the funniest because school districts are notoriously dicey when it comes to how we report and calculate capital outlays. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's just all kinds of problems here.
You know, and I still would say, I mean, my hypothesis would be that some of these KIPP schools are spending a lot of money. I mean, I'm not going to be surprised if we find out that that these per pupil expenses are very high.
Right.
But, you know, but the reality is that the way generally, and I haven't looked at their report carefully, but almost all the times we do these comparisons, that the capital costs actually aren't factored into that per pupil outlay number.
Right. Mm-hmm,
so this stuff's just not included. Right. So we're including it for X, but not for Y. That creates a problem in comparability.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, how many people seem motivated to discredit KIPP? It's like if you can discredit Michelle Rhee now, mm-hmm. you put a chink in the armor of school reform. If you can discredit KIPP, it gets so personalized mm-hmm. in many ways.
Who are the researchers that did this, Amber?
Gary Myron, do you know Gary?
Yeah, I know Gary.
Is he invited to join you at
Paddy's? Everybody's invited. We talk these things through. I find it useful. But what was your take on what prompted them to...
I mean, I felt like, and there were a couple really, I mean, we're trying to privatize schools. I mean, there are like two or three sentences in there that might as well have been written by the union. I mean, you read them and it just sounds like completely, you know, I mean, if you didn't know it had any union funding, you could read two or three of these sentences and realize that this has been co-opted. And that was disappointing for me.
Who published this?
It was out of, let's see, that what's that private, Henry Levin's, what's that,
National Center for Privatization.
Really? You know, I'd like to think the Think Tank Review Project is going to really go in and scrutinize this.
That would be a great idea.
Great idea.
That's a good suggestion. Let's make sure that our friend Kevin Wellner hears that.
You should challenge in the Gadfly when you do the write-up. Mm-hmm. You should ask Kevin to take up that mantle.
Okay, so again, Gary Myron, if you're listening, Kevin Wellner, meet Amber and Rick at Paddo's on Bourbon. You guys can hash this all out. Okay,
indeed.
What's the song that goes with this?
So since we're talking about researchers who got it wrong, we have a song about a woman wronged. That would be Carrie Underwood in Before He Cheats.
Behind our songs seem to be getting more and more stretched thin.
Yes.
I can't even remember how a song about, Before He Cheats has anything to do with Gary Myron.
No.
But it would be a good song if we were talking about the cheating scandal that's going on in some parts
of
the country.
Yeah, that was my thinking. Yeah. This is, if you think of like a little tiny string tethering like a 30,000 foot like helium balloon to a fire hydrant.
Mm-hmm.
That is about the tenuousness of our relationship on these song titles.
Well said. Well, you know who's not tenuous? Chris Irvine in his segment, What's Up With That?
I woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that? What's up with that?
Chris, wearing purple, looking sharp. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here. How's it going, Rick?
It's going good. It's going good. It's purple. It's kind of like, looks like a Belarusian St. Patrick's Day thing.
A little bit, you know, just feeling the spring, nice weather outside.
Did you see Chris's dance moves in our video last week?
Dude.
I know.
Your whole staff can break it. Oh, I got to say, Joe was the monster.
Yeah.
With the arm tip thing, man, it took me back 20-odd years.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I know. We're going to have a Fordham dance party. We'll invite everybody. It'll be a lot of fun. Yeah, up on our roof deck.
You know what? Mostly, though, when the girls were doing the hoodie strings.
Yeah.
That was so Breakfast Club.
Yeah, it was. What about the chairs turning in unison?
And then the freeze moment, and then the unwind.
Classic. Dude. Classic.
Outstanding. Y'all should play that on a continuous loop out front.
Well, that's good. It's definitely for recruiting and for our funder meetings. We're going to show them that.
Yeah. Well, it makes you guys look like a lot more fun than you really are.
That's the idea. Okay, Chris, with that, what's up with that? What you got for us?
All right, well, I've previously discussed various ways in which schools and districts have tried to deal with curbing dress code violations. From irkling students, that's zip-tying baggy pants well above the waist, to fining them, dealing with the dilemma of fashion gone too far has been successfully accomplished before. But apparently the problem has become an epidemic in Arkansas, as the state's governor recently signed into law a bill that bans students from wearing clothing that exposes, quote, underwear, buttocks, or the breast of a female. So I'm to believe student outerwear has gotten so out of control in Razorback schools that a statewide law is necessary? What's up with that? I'm curious as to how state officials plan on enforcing this law. I imagine they could get pretty creative with it. For instance, principals could be fined for every square inch of visible boxer shorts seen throughout their school. Or maybe Arkansas could do more with less by having meter maids double as saggy outfit enforcers, patrolling schools and writing tickets to any student with the audacity to wear their underwear at their waist, but their pants at their hips. Look, I'm all in favor of enforcing dress code violations, but there's better ways of going about it that don't raise serious underlying race and I'm all in favor of enforcing dress code violations, but there's better ways of going about it that don't raise serious underlying race and class implications like this law, specifically against saggy pants. While they're at it, why not prohibit cafeterias from serving fried chicken, cornbread, and collard greens in an effort to make students healthier? It would be just the same in my book.
Well, I didn't expect Chris to go there.
Wow. We were saying the logic tethering our songs was a little dicey. I totally don't see how you got to A to B on that one.
I mean, Chris, isn't it true that, I mean, the whole, you know, ghetto culture, whatever you want to say, is now like picked up probably more by upper middle class, you know, boys than anybody else? I'm sure there's white kids out there sagging their pants, right?
No, I mean, I'm sure that's the case. But if you look at the majority of in where that trend started, the majority
of the students... I don't care where it started. I don't want to see kids' underwear. I think having kids show a lot of underwear is destructive to a disciplined school culture. I think schools that are run by African-American principals and Latino principals and white principals all want to see less underwear from their students. And I think tackling this and getting kids to actually pull their damn pants up is eminently defensible. And if it has racial overtones, so be it.
But hold on, Rick. Are you saying that you support a statewide law on this topic?
No.
That's my issue with it. I agree with everything you're saying, no. Rick. But
it sounded like you were saying that going after the problem itself is racist.
No, not at all. But a statewide law that's picking specifically at the type of dress code violations that have started and really came out of the African American community.
I don't care where it came out of. I do think trying to regulate dress from state capitals is probably dubious unless you're going for something which is easily enforceable, which is why I am for, you know, the body sheath.
Yes, that's
I say you mandate it. I'm thinking orange jumpsuit, every kid age 6 to 18 statewide.
I like that.
You can do simple variations. You can let kids do insignia on the sleeves if you want to let them customize. But this is a way to make sure that all the privates are covered.
Yeah, but look, here's the bigger problem. Statewide, what happens with the online schools in Arkansas? Huh? How are you going to enforce this? Kids at home in their underwear, you don't know that. You can't tell. I mean, is this a law? Do they have to? Hey, I don't care if the kid's naked if they're at home and there's no, video camera.
If you're going body sheath, baby, it's not a problem. If that kid steps foot out of home and it's not body sheathed, their parents get a fine.
Oh, but if they're online learning from home, they don't have to wear it? That seems like a double standard.
Meh. Meh.
I want to know, do any online schools have school uniform requirements? That's another great idea for a study. Ask your AERA friends about that one.
Mm.
Okay, Chris, thanks for that and for your sensitivity to these racial and class issues.
Thanks for having me on the show, guys.
Okay, that's all the time we got for this week. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C., For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.